From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, are we asking too much of our pets? Are dogs taking the emotional place of friends or family? And is it putting too much pressure on the animals? We talk with journalist and dog trainer John Katz. In his latest book, The New Work of Dogs, he explores the relationship between people and their dogs and makes the case for treating your dog like a dog rather than your best friend. Katz has two border collies. Dogs, coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. The Senate has passed a bill banning the process opponents call partial birth abortion. The House has already passed a similar measure, and President Bush has said he'll sign what would be the first federal ban on abortion in 30 years. Abortion rights activists say they'll challenge the bill in court as soon as it's signed into law. It makes no exceptions to guard the health of the mother. Iran today agreed to suspend uranium enrichment and allow unrestricted UN inspections of its nuclear program. The agreement followed talks between European Union foreign ministers and Iranian officials over Tehran's controversial nuclear energy program. From Tehran, NPR's Kate Seeley has more.
The foreign ministers of Britain, France, and Germany traveled here to press Iran about its nuclear program. The International Atomic Energy Agency, or IAEA, wants Iran to disprove fears that it's secretly developing nuclear weapons. Iran claims its nuclear program is for peaceful purposes, but has not been fully cooperating with the UN agency. After talks with European ministers, however, Tehran said it would sign an additional protocol to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. The protocol allows UN inspectors unfettered access to Iran's nuclear sites. Tehran also agreed to a temporary suspension of its uranium enrichment program. The three EU ministers hailed the agreement, saying they would help reduce tensions in the region. Kate Seeley, NPR News, Tehran.
President Bush has been sending letters to leaders of the Gulf states and appealing to his counterparts in Asia in person to drum up more financial help to rebuild Iraq. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
With the donors' conference set for later this week in Madrid, administration officials have been trying to overcome the reluctance of many countries that don't want to be seen as supporting the U.S. occupation. New trust funds are being set up that will be managed by the World Bank and the United Nations rather than by U.S. authorities in Iraq. The UN and World Bank estimate Iraq will need $35.8 billion over the next few years to revive its economy. Several countries have made pledges so far, including a $1.5 billion pledge from Japan. The World Bank says it will offer somewhere between $3 to $5 billion over a five-year period, a mixture of grants and loans. The World Bank says lending will be subject to Iraq's debt level and security on the ground. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
Prosecutors in the trial of Washington-area sniper suspect John Allen Muhammad said today Muhammad was relying too much on the lawyers he dismissed for advice. Muhammad won the right yesterday to defend himself. The judge agreed, and Muhammad has consented to physically separate himself from the lawyers who are serving in a standby capacity. Today on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials finished down 30 points at 97.47, an active trade of over 1.4 billion shares. The Nasdaq closed up 15 at 19.41. This is NPR News. Florida Governor Jeb Bush today ordered a feeding tube reinserted into Terri Schiavo, the comatose woman who's been at the center of a legal battle over whether she can be allowed to die. The Florida legislature passed a measure allowing Governor Bush to give the order. George Filos, the lawyer for Schiavo's husband who wants the tube out, said the issue has now expanded.
The fight is no longer about Terri. It's about the rights of every one of us to control our own lives. It's about whether your choices will be honored through the courts of this land.
Schiavo's parents wanted the tube reinserted and claim she's making progress. Police in Niagara Falls, Canada, have formally charged a man who took a plunge over Niagara Falls. They say he did it intentionally. From member station WNED, Mike Mroziak reports.
40-year-old Kirk Jones of Canton, Michigan, faces up to $10,000 in fines if convicted of mischief and illegally attempting a stunt. Witnesses say Jones entered the water Monday and plunged from the Canadian Falls wearing only his clothes. Niagara Parks Police Inspector Paul Forcier says the jump was a deliberate stunt, not a suicide attempt, but he would not explain the motive.
Actually, all I can say at this point is that it was investigation that revealed that this was an intentional act in our view, hence the charges.
Only one other person has plunged from Niagara Falls outside a barrel and lived. Roger Woodward, then 7 years old, was swept over the brink following a 1960 boating accident. He survived the fall wearing only his life preserver. For NPR News, I'm Mike Mroziak in Buffalo.
Internet retailer Amazon.com reports its first-ever profit in a non-holiday quarter. Amazon said its revenues grew on free shipping incentives and the establishment of a new sporting goods store. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News in Washington.
The NPR Shop introduces the music compilation Shake These Blues, the latest release in the I Heard It on NPR CD series at NPR.org.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of Dow Osmond's The Stones of Summer, inspiration for the film Stone Reader, available at Barnes & Noble bookstores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Calico Corners, your home for custom decorating, with over 100 stores across the country, on the web at calicocorners.com. And from DK Publishing, publishers of Smithsonian Institution, The Story of the West, a history of the American West and its people.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I love my cat, and I'm sure you love your pet. My guest, John Katz, is devoted to his dogs, but here's the question he's raising. Are we asking too much of our pets? Are we relying on them for the company and emotional support that we're not getting from friends and family? And are we asking things from them that go against their nature? Katz discusses these questions in his latest book, The New Work of Dogs. His previous book, A Dog Year, was about the death of his two Labrador retrievers and how he raised and trained two border collies. Katz is also a member of the Association of Pet Dog Trainers, but yes, he does have a life apart from his dogs. He's the author of 12 books, including his series of suburban detective novels. He's written for the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and Wired, and he's a contributing editor to the public radio program Marketplace. John Katz, welcome back to Fresh Air. Now, unfortunately, I'm in a studio in Philadelphia, and you're in a studio in Newark, New Jersey. I wish we were in the same studio, because you have your dogs with you, and I'd actually love to meet them. What do you do to convince them to be quiet during interviews?
They are amazing. They're working dogs. They're border collies, Homer and Orson, and they have become media whores, really. They come into the studio. They go right to sleep the minute I start speaking about dogs, and they stay asleep, usually, until I stop. And then they're up and about. But they've been to, it must be 80, 90 bookstores and events, and they really love bookstores. They love dog people. They get treats. They end up in somebody's lap. And they love dark studios, which are like dens for them, I think. They just curl up and sit there.
Well, let's get to your latest book. It's called The New Work of Dogs, and it's about, let me say this. You know, dogs have always been called man's best friend, but your book is about new ways that people are depending on dogs, and you ask a lot of questions about whether or not that's good for the people or the dogs. What are some of the new ways that you think dogs are figuring into the emotional lives of people?
In the last 25 or 30 years, I really date this to the rise of television. And the decline in the extended family and the rise in divorce rates and more people living alone and work becoming unstable for many people. People have begun to use dogs in a more intensely personal way as either human surrogates, substitutes for people in cases where they're lonely or disconnected or fragmented, or as members of the family. Dogs are getting human names, they're sleeping in bed. I kind of joke sometimes that, you know, the boomers created the gifted and talented child, and now they're working on the gifted and talented dog. Where, you know, one woman came to me at a reading and said, well, you know, Mondays we do agility and Tuesdays we do obedience and Wednesday we go herding, and what can I do on Thursdays and Fridays? I said, well, maybe the guy should just, you know, sit in the yard and, you know, sniff some other dog's butt or something, you know, let him relax. I think there is this astonishing emotional intensity around people and their animals, dogs and cats, I should say, that is accelerating. I call it the emotionalization of dogs, people seeing dogs as as spiritual, as telepathic, as soulmates, as intense, close as kids with fur. And it's sometimes a very beautiful thing. You know, I'm crazy about my dogs. We go sheep herding, we chase geese, we do all kinds of stuff, and I would be embarrassed to tell you the things I do for these dogs. On the other hand, I found the subject to be a little darker and more complicated than I thought when I entered it. Because I think the culture kind of glorifies the human-dog bond for good reason. It's quite wonderful. But sometimes it's a bit unthinking and uncritical to the extent that there aren't a lot of people really wondering whether this view of dogs as human-like is really good for them, or whether, I guess I ended up wondering myself whether it's really good for people.
So you're seeing this like new relationship between people and their dogs as being troubling because of what it says about people's people-to-people relationships. Are you watching dogs become more neurotic as people are relying on them more for love and companionship and telepathy and mysticism and all these other things?
Yes, I think there's enormous evidence, and I think any trainer would agree with me. For one thing, last year in the United States, 400,000 children were bitten severely enough to require hospitalization, which is a staggering rise. You see dogs are increasingly under pressure, neurotic, chewing up the house, jumping on people. You have the new element of the rescue dog, the abused dog, which dog that certainly exists. But this all becomes an element in our ability to do what I think is our primary responsibility with animals, which is to show them how to live in the world, which means training them, which means thinking about how we get them, thinking about the kind of dog or cat that we get, whether it's right for us, and then doing the work to help it acclimate to an increasingly hostile world. So I do see behavior that's very, very increasingly neurotic, and as the dogs are being pressured to do things dogs really can't do.
Like what? What are some of the things dogs are being pressured to do?
Well, people perceive dogs as loving them unconditionally and uncritically, and to some extent that's certainly true. But dogs really can't understand when we're depressed or when we had a bad day at work, or they really can't give us the kind of emotional support that human beings can give us.
They can't say to you, "Your boss was wrong. You're right."
Well, I had a great, you know, my first shocking introduction to this actually was when I took my border collie, Orson, who had a lot of problems, out to a trainer in Pennsylvania named Carolyn Wilkie. And I said, you know, Carolyn, I said, I'm having terrible trouble with this dog. You know, the problem is he's so attached to me. I think if anything happened to me, why, you just have to shoot him because he couldn't live with anybody else. And I remember her getting right in my face and saying, "Listen, pal, if anything happened to you, I would buy a can of beef liver. And in 2 days, this dog would forget that you ever walked the earth. And don't you forget it." And this was a bit of a shock to me, but it was something I really needed to hear because I could see the truth of it. It doesn't mean that he doesn't love me or that I don't love him, but it was a reminder to me that I was beginning to project onto him things that were mine, an attitude about authority. I saw him as being rebellious and devious and willful, and these were things that were much more true of me than of him. The problem was I just didn't know how to train him.
John Katz is my guest. His new book is called The New Work of Dogs. You've come across people who are afraid to discipline their dogs, or at least unwilling to train and discipline their dogs. You say that discipline is not only important for the human who has a dog in his or her life, it's important for the dog, that dogs need discipline. They need to know what they're supposed to do and what they're not supposed to do. Why? Why do dogs, for their own sake, need discipline?
Well, for several reasons. In the first instance, almost everything dogs like to do, squabble with each other, have sex, roll in disgusting stuff, is either frowned upon or illegal. They're not, you know, in the state of New Jersey where I live, there's no longer one place in the entire state where it's legal to run a dog off a leash. And dogs, of course, instinctively, need to run and expect to run, want to run. So the environment, 60% of the country does not like dogs or have dogs, one or the other. Dog owners are a minority, and this wave of legislation and rules being passed that are restricting where dogs can go. There are lawsuits when dogs misbehave, liability issues, insurance questions. So we have all these dogs. You know, in 1960, there were 15 million owned dogs. Last year, there were 68 million owned dogs, plus 10 million dogs in the shelter system, 5 million of whom will be euthanized this year. And they live in a world that is increasingly, was not built for them, and is increasingly uncomfortable having so many of them running around so much. So the imperative to train a dog, you know, training is not about where the dog poops. Training is not about, cleanliness. Training is about the dog's relationship not only to you, but to the world beyond.
You've said that when you got dogs, instead of sending the dogs to dog training school, you sent yourself to a dog trainer so that you could learn how to train dogs.
I did, and I found a very good one, and she beat up on me pretty good and still does. But one of the things she said, which also affected this book and led to my wanting to do this book, you know, at some point my daughter jokes that I've spent my middle age trying to get this border collie to lie down, which is, we're into our fourth year, and we're getting there. And at one point, I was very frustrated with him, and Carolyn said, listen, Kat, she said, if you want to have the dog you want, I'm afraid you're just going to have to become a better human being. And there's really no shortcut. Now, this is not the sort of thing you expect to hear from a trainer, but sadly, it was also true. And what she was talking about was that in order to show a dog how to live in the world, train a dog, get the dog you want, I had to be less angry, less impatient, calmer. And the work that I had to do is really on me. The dog essentially knows what he or she wants to do. You know, they sort of come with this basic set of ideas about how they want to live. And it was my job to deal with him in a more effective way. So trainers always say they don't really train the dogs, they train the people, and there's a lot of truth to that. But if you don't bring some self-awareness of your own life, in my case, you know, I was projecting a very difficult adolescence onto my dog, who was behaving to me like a difficult adolescent. And you don't need to be a shrink to see the things I was putting on him. When you see a dog as defying you or being willful or being devious or being difficult, you're going to treat the dog in a particular way. You're going to assert yourself or get angry and get impatient and get frustrated, which makes things a lot worse. So I found myself in this extraordinary position, really, as a writer, because I'm not, a dog trainer. I found myself confronted with this sort of shocking reality that, you know, in my mid-50s, I had hit this dog was requiring me to do additional work on myself beyond the many years of therapy I had already paid for.
Breeds often have special, you know, different breeds of dogs often have special skills, a special type of intelligence, and special needs. You have border collies that you've gotten from breeders.
Right.
What are the unique qualities of border collies?
Well, these dogs have to have work to do or they go nuts. You know, they're very intense. They're very energetic. So we do all kinds of work. We clear geese out of neighborhood parks and schoolyards. We go do sheep herding 3 or 4 times a week. We go for lots of walks a day. This is a good example of a breed. They're great dogs, but if you don't have work for them to do, they're not good dogs to have. And you see them all over the place in cities now, ever since the movie Babe came out. And it's a good example. I mean, it's the same with dogs like Labs and Retrievers. They're wonderful dogs, but they need to have work. They need to have exercise. A lot of breeds have very distinct characteristics. Springer Spaniels, for example, have a reason why they're called Springers. And there's a number of breeds, you know, Bichons and Westies and other dogs that really like to be in apartments and don't need a lot of exercise and don't mind being left alone. There are very good breeds for people in almost every circumstance if you do the work. They're dogs that are fine in apartments, dogs that don't mind being left alone for hours if they get some exercise. But the marketing of dogs in America, the emotionalization of them sort of is leading people to, you know, it's like the bigger and more energetic the dog, in the suburbs, the more likely people are to get it. So you see Labs and Retrievers all over the place, these big 100-pound dogs with no chance to run anywhere, no exercise, and who are not trained. It was probably the saddest thing that I saw, to be truthful.
My guest is John Katz. His latest book is called The New Work of Dogs. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. One of the needs that your pet will never be able to fill is keeping you informed about news from around the world and bringing you entertaining and informative interviews. That is the job of public radio, and we can't do it without your support. Thank you. We're going to continue our interview with John Katz in a few minutes. Many public radio stations are fundraising today, so while they take a fundraising break, we're going to listen to the blues. In our era of overexposed overnight pop stars, it's hard to imagine that 40 years ago, popular music was a rarity in any medium but jukeboxes and radio. Television mostly featured established pop or jazz stars, or the occasional rock and roller with a new hit. But in Germany, two promoters had another idea. Beginning in 1962, they toured a group of American blues masters throughout Europe and got them top-quality exposure on German television. Now, for the first time, Americans can watch these shows. They've been released on DVD. Music critic Milo Miles has a review.
I think everyone would agree that the most captivating parts of the recent blues series that aired on PBS were the archival footage of blues performers, and it would be nice if there were more of it around. Well, the biggest and best new hunk of it I've seen in a long time appears on the two DVD set called The American Folk Blues Festival, 1962 to 1966. The pioneering tour packages arranged by German promoters Fritz Rau and Horst Lippmann helped American blues performers connect with the steady, appreciative European audiences that jazz players discovered a generation earlier. No surprise the concerts went over well. The German TV shows present a roster of amazingly high quality. T-Bone Walker, Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, Junior Wells, Memphis Slim, Sonny Boy Williamson, Big Mama Thornton, Otis Rush, Victoria Spivey, and more. Some excellent bonus clips from 1969 feature late-period Chicago players Earl Hooker and Magic Sam. Other performers, such as Big Joe Williams and Roosevelt Sykes, harken back to the blues of the 30s. But most of the lineup is associated with Chess Records in the 50s. Many were as close to prime years as we would ever see them, and the shows have a vitality and crispness equaled only by a few later performances at the Newport Folk Festival. Until you get used to it, the TV show format seems hokey. Each performer gets just a number or two, and they're delivered on stage sets intended to be Deep South honky-tonks and big city dives. But back then, every film music number had Broadway window dressing. Just presenting a performance on a simple stage was foolishly considered lowballing it. Fortunately, a few of them are done in that straightforward way on American Folk Blues Festival.
Put you down for a while. Well, you know I can't quit you, baby. But I gotta put you down for a while. Yes, you messed up my happy home, baby. Treat my only child.
And no setting can cut these players' charisma.
Yes, you know
they can embody cool, like Otis Rush, even with his high pompadour and fuzzy sweater, like Lightnin' Hopkins with his semi-dark shades and slinky body language. The hulking Sonny Boy Williamson and Howlin' Wolf give off an undeniable hint of menace. Others have the dignified air of classic deep chops pro entertainers, like Victoria Spivey and her longtime accompanist Lonnie Johnson. There are wonderful surprises. Who knew Roosevelt Sykes was such a flamboyant man at the piano, with his writhing shoulders and vigorous guffaws? And there are frustrating mysteries, like Willie Dixon. He was a superb bass player and a songwriter whose street-smart lyricism made him the Smokey Robinson of Chess Records. How could he be such a stiff, inexpressive singer? But more important, how could it be that nobody filmed the hugely popular and influential T-Bone Walker before 1962?
Hey, baby, don't throw your love on me so strong. Hey, baby, don't throw your love on me so strong. You know your love is like a faucet. You can turn it off or on.
The American Folk Blues Festival performances give us a glimpse into three vanished worlds. First is the south side of Chicago in full blues cry, unaware that its time was already fading. The second is TV, where music is a rarity, particularly music like hardcore blues. And the third is a culture where blues was still underground, its spells and rituals not yet suitable for the mainstream.
Milo Miles reviewed the American Folk Blues Festival DVDs on the Hippo Universal Music Label. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Come on, babe. Do the dog. Do the dog.
Coming up, Training Dogs. We continue our conversation with John Katz, author of The New Work of Dogs.
Do the dog.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Rodale Incorporated, publishers of Not Fade Away, A Short Life Well Lived by Lawrence Shames and Peter Barton. The book tells the story of Barton's maverick life and unique response to dying young, at bookstores everywhere.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with John Katz. He's a journalist, novelist, and dog trainer. His latest book, The New Work of Dogs, examines the emotional reliance that many of us have on our pets and suggests that if we treat dogs like our best friends, we may be forgetting to treat them like dogs. Katz has two border collies, and he's a member of the Association of Pet Dog Trainers. Well, you know, you said that you got your border collies and that they need to work, and you take them to sheep herd a few times a week. Do you have a lot of farms within your area that have sheep?
There actually are more than you might think. I actually go to Pennsylvania, which is only an hour from me, and we actually take care of a couple of hundred sheep. We graze them several times, three or four times a week, and I have come to love that quite a bit. I'm probably the least likely person on the planet to be doing that, but I've really come to love doing that with the dogs. You don't have to go, there's other kinds of work you can do, from agility work to just going to parks and throwing balls and frisbees around, but it's been quite extraordinary for me to be involved with the dogs and with sheep, because you sort of see why there are dogs when you do something like that. And the dog people are quite wonderful. You know, the dog lovers will do almost anything for their dogs once they figure out what it is they ought to be doing.
Well, taking your dog to herd sheep a few times a week, isn't that like when your kids were young and you had to take them to dance lessons or music lessons after school?
Yes, I did that too. Well, it's a little bit like that, although I think I actually just bought a farm in upstate New York. I'm going to have my own sheep in about a month. But it's not the only thing you can do. It is like that. I think the impulse is very similar. You know, I am a boomer, and I try to take care of the creatures under my charge. But, of course, I write about dogs, and I work at home. So I'm in a good position to give them the things that they need. You could have a border collie or a golden retriever and still work away from home, but you have to work harder to get them the work and exercise that they need.
Your dogs, I think, also have like degrees in shepherding, don't they? they got their herding qualifying test. Is it a multiple choice or essay?
Well, I'm not one to brag, but Homer has a couple of titles. The truth is, you know, I gave up the trialing because of the very thing.
You gave up what?
I gave up the trialing. I'd take the sheep out to graze, but the trialing where you compete for ribbons.
Oh.
I gave that up because of what you were talking about before. The people were not having any fun. I mean, everybody was screaming at their dogs. They looked grim. The dogs weren't having fun. The people weren't having fun. The pressure on the dogs was enormous. I stopped doing that. I didn't like what it potentially could have triggered in me. And I don't really care about the ribbons. I just learned enough so that my dogs can take these sheep out to pasture and take care of them and watch over them that way.
How did you get your border collies?
A breeder in Texas read Running to the Mountain, which was not about dogs, but had two dogs in it, two labs, my previous dogs.
This is about a six-month break you took from your real life to live alone on a mountain with your dogs.
Right. That's basically right. It was somewhat a book about Thomas Merton and some of his writings about solitude, experience with solitude, I guess, and was part of the book. And I went with two labs, without whom I don't think I could have survived the experience. They kept me company, and they were quite great. One of the dogs, whenever he wanted to play, he would come up and nip me on the butt and get me moving. And I recounted this in the book. And this breeder, Deanna, in Texas, read it, and she said, "Now that's a person that could have a border collie." And she had this very troubled dog. At the time, his name was Devin, who was a sort of failed obedience dog. And had been confined for several months in a crate, and it was just a mess. And she shipped him to Newark and said, "You know, I have this feeling from reading your work that you will keep faith with this dog, that you'll do whatever it takes to work things out with this dog." And he was a nightmare. He was practically destroyed my neighborhood, my house, dented my marriage pretty good. Was jumping through windows, hurting school buses. He was just out of his mind. And that's what began this whole journey of sort of understanding. I loved him right away, of course, and identified with him. And in order to keep him, I knew I was going to have to learn a lot more about dogs than I knew. And that's what started the whole turn towards dog riding. And the fact that he can lie here like this is a miracle, really.
So you had this that ornery dog that wasn't behaving, and you had to train him in order to be able to live with the dog and have the dog live in your community, and in order to remain married.
That's right. Right. So, in order to not have windows and all that sort of thing.
I mean, there's a difference, I think, between training a puppy where all the puppy's behaviors are just kind of like puppy behaviors, but they haven't really learned a lot yet. You don't have to unteach them a lot of things. Compared to an adult dog that's had something of a life, and you have to totally refashion their behavior, where did you start?
This was one of the most difficult things I'd ever done in my life. It's still ongoing. I think it will never be quite finished, but I don't think I've ever taken on a harder thing for me because it spoke directly to my own problems as a human. Impatience and anger and frustration and short attention span and distraction and all the things that get in the way of doing what he needed. And I loved him, of course, right away and was confronted with this very simple drama. Either I learned about dogs, and I was surprised, by the way, how little I knew about dogs. I thought I knew more than I did. When I started hanging around with trainers, I did take a training course and became a trainer to research the new work of dogs. I don't train dogs, but I learned enough about it so that I could know a little bit of what I was writing about. I was stunned that I was almost everything I thought about dogs was wrong. Everything I thought was going on in his head was wrong. The way I was communicating with him was wrong. My tone of voice was wrong. The repetition of commands was wrong. My whole understanding of what he was about was wrong. And when I realized how essentially simple, how food-driven, how attention-driven he was, it became, I wouldn't say easy, very, very manageable to do. But in order to do that, I had to acknowledge, you know, repeatedly that almost every assumption I had about dogs was not right.
What's one or two of the things that you were doing wrong?
Well, the first thing, of course, is the most common. I was anthropomorphizing him. I was attributing all sorts of human-like emotions to him. I was, you know, he was being devious. He was being rebellious. He was being willful. He was being stubborn. He was jealous. He was all these things that humans are that are not really dog traits. What he really was confused. You know, he couldn't tell friend from foe. He didn't understand what people were asking. I mean, he didn't make sense of the world. This is, by the way, why I started with the sheep. I mean, I'm not a person who's naturally inclined to spend time with sheep, but it's just not in my repertoire. But everything I read about border collies, including this trainer in Ireland who I was emailing with, said, look, this dog will not make sense of the world until he does what he's supposed to do and gets around some livestock for a while. And that was true. I mean, he's not much of a sheepdog. He's much too skitsy and intense for that. But the world is beginning to make sense to him, and that was very good advice. But I think this whole idea, the less I saw him as a human version of me and the more I saw him as a dog, the easier it was to train him, the better behaved he became, and the happier he and I are, and the more likely I was to remain married.
Did you do the whole reward and punishment approach?
I came into the hands of a positive reinforcement trainer who does not do punishment. She does, and this is Carolyn, she's very tough about that. You basically give the dog the chance to succeed and praise it with a combination of food and verbal and physical reward. And you don't yell at it or scold it or correct it or throw things at it or put electronic devices on it. You just praise them when they're doing the right thing.
Why no punishment?
Well, the positive reinforcement, which is a growing training in the dog world, really holds that yelling and throwing things and criticism makes them more stressed and that they end up having displaced aggression and displaced neurotic behavior, that they don't, any more than kids, they don't like being yelled at. And they don't like having things thrown at them. And they don't like having people scream in their faces. And that you know, like a kid, you can get a dog to do anything by scaring it. But as also with a kid, that's not the best way to do it. I'm embarrassed to tell you that a new dog arrived in my household last week, a puppy from Colorado named Rose. And I'm training her in this positive way from the beginning. And it's amazing to me, in 24 hours, this dog comes and sits happily and lies down and is housebroken. I'm a great believer in that. Now, I'm not 100% positive person, you know, so I sometimes will lose it, as we all will, which is fine. But I think it's a great training method. I think it really works. I think the dog responds very quickly. And best of all, you have this great grounded relationship with a dog. It's born out of real positive affection and not out of terror or intimidation, which I think is great.
My guest is John Katz. His latest book is called The New Work of Dogs. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Katz, author of The New Work of Dogs and A Dog Year. Okay, housebreaking a dog. I mean, when I was growing up, I didn't have a dog, sadly. But the people who I saw training their dogs, what they would do is if the dog, like, pooped in the house, they would bring the dog over to the poop, basically stick the dog's nose in it, spank them a little bit, and then put them either on the newspaper or outside, wherever it was that they wanted to direct the dog to be pooping in the future. That's negative reinforcement, right?
Yeah, that's a great. I did that with my labs. I mean, I did that with many dogs. The way I housebroke Rose or Homer in a day or two was I got a crate. I put the puppy in the crate, fed the dog in the crate, waited 30 minutes, carried the dog outside. The dog immediately went to the bathroom. I danced around in the moonlight, yelling and whooping and throwing food around. And three times, and the dog was housebroken. I didn't drag her. I didn't stick her nose in it. I didn't scream at her. I didn't do any bad dog. And it worked in 24 hours. I've done that with two dogs now.
You feed them in a box, and then 30 minutes later...
You just feed them in the crate. You get a kennel crate, and they like it. It makes them feel safe. Uh-huh. You give them their food in the crate. You just put the bowl in the crate. You close the crate. You go, you know, read the paper or watch television. In a half an hour or so, you come back. You open the crate. You pick the dog out. Take the dog outside. The dog will almost immediately go to the bathroom because puppies go quickly after they eat. And then you just praise the dog. You make a lot of noise. You give it a treat. You tell how good they are. You get excited and dance around and look like a jerk. And it's, I mean, I've twice now, I've housebroken dogs in about a day. Now you'll have occasional accidents or something, but they're happy. You know, this is an interesting thing to talk about, Terry, because it goes to the heart of why I wrote the book. It's a good example of why the more you understand what dogs are like and treat them as dogs, the easier it is to do these things. Housebreaking is really very simple. Dogs prefer to go outside. And they don't like to be yelled at. It just makes them more nervous and more likely to pee all over the place. So this is such a simple thing. I mean, the way I learned to teach my dogs to come to me before, I used to yell and scream and throw chains and jump around and make a lot of noise to no effect. Now I just get, I put a bunch of meatballs in my hand and I walk backwards. There's not a dog on the planet that won't come running towards you. And when they come to me, I give her the meatball and say, good girl, good come. And she knows how to come. And I didn't, you know, there's no yelling or throwing or stomping or you know, or shock collars or any of this dreadful stuff. I sometimes think when I spent this year with people and their dogs that what I saw was a country, as much as we love our dogs, we're almost having a civil war with them. Because we all know people like this who, I'm sorry my dog jumped on you, but he was abused, so I can't train him. Or she's always been aggressive with people. Or she's always hated female dogs. Or she's always chewed up the house. People live with these awful behaviors and are constantly yelling and tugging at their dogs and scolding them and clucking about them. And it's too bad because it doesn't need to be like that, really. And it was frustrating, really, to see.
Dogs seem to, you know, in the best of circumstances, want to please the main people in their lives. Why do dogs want to please people? What do they get out of it outside of the meatball?
There's two great questions revolving around that question. One is, why do dogs want to please people? And also, why do people love dogs? Because in a Darwinian sense, we could live very happily without dogs at all. And why, when we're so rough on all these species, are we so nice to dogs, you know, when we're not nice to most species? The answer in both cases is really the same. Dogs want to please us because we feed them and we take care of them. And dogs are just the wiliest species there is in terms of look at how they're taken care of. We shelter them, we protect them, we give them great stuff, we give them gourmet treats. Some dogs I could mention sleep on L.L. Bean's cedar beds that cost $100. I don't want to mention any names.
Like John Katz, for instance?
Well, I don't know. I have no comment on that. But why do we do that? There was a great research I came across, you know, working with the University of Kentucky. I got tons of great studies about this. And this great writer named John Archer in England, who's a psychologist, he was obsessed with this idea of why do people love dogs so much when they, in a Darwinian sense, they don't really do anything for us. And the answer, which speaks directly to your question, is dogs fool us. They show a range of emotions. They show affection. They show neediness. They show hostility. And they then trick us. We see these few emotions, and we are then drawn into thinking they have the whole range of emotions, and we then attach to them. And what Archer wrote, which I thought was quite wonderful, was that this makes dogs the most effective social parasites in the history of the world. In the most benign sense of the term, because a social parasite is a species which injects itself into the social system of another species and lives off of it. And dogs are really brilliant at this, at getting us to think that they're just like us, so that we will protect and shelter them and lavish them with great food and treats and drive out three times a week to show them sheep.
John, I have a question I have to ask you here. Is this dog thing like part of a midlife crisis? No, seriously. And I mean that, like, I mean, I really understand how much people can love animals. At the same time, it's like you've invested so much of your life in this. It's your main subject for writing about. You're devoting your days, in part because you're writing about it, to taking care of your dogs. I know your children are grown now. And I, from what I know, I think you used to be a very devoted father. I mean, not that you're not anymore, but you had tasks you had to do that you no longer have to do surrounding your children. So, you know, so let's be blunt. Are you having a midlife crisis?
Well, I laugh because people have been asking me that since I was 20. So,
oh, right. Okay.
I think whenever men change, people ask them if they're having a midlife crisis.
That's probably true.
And I don't know, quite what the term means, in the sense that I'm having a gas. You know, I can't say I've ever been happier. I have a great marriage. I have a great kid. I love writing about dogs. I think people are put off in some way or puzzled by change, and I love change. And you know, I used to work in media, and I used to write mysteries. Now, when I wrote mysteries. I mean, I used to write novels, then I wrote mysteries. No one asked me if I was having a midlife crisis. Well, actually, some people did. When I went to the mountain, people asked me if I was having a midlife crisis. I think this process for me is very exciting. I don't really write about dogs, as I'm sure you know. I write about people, the people who own the dogs. And dogs are a wonderful way into people, because dogs are life itself. When you get to hang around the dogs, people let you into their lives and reveal themselves as a writer in a way that never happens, hardly ever happens. And I'm genuinely drawn into the rich emotional geography that exists between people and their pets. So for me, there's nothing of the sense of crisis about it. It's really a blast. I love the dog people. I love the dogs. And I especially love writing about it. I feel, after years and years and years of trying this or that, that I've really found my thing as a writer. That's what I'm good at. So I guess the answer, honestly, it's a perfectly fair question. I would have to say no. I think it's just a lot of fun, very exciting for me.
Well, John Katz, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Terry.
John Katz's latest book is called The New Work of Dogs. His other books include A Dog Year and Running to the Mountain. This is Fresh Air. Public radio stations around the country are fundraising this week, so I want to explain something about Fresh Air. Each station that carries our program has to pay a fee, and that money helps fund our program. That's how most of the national programs operate. Right now, your station is relying on Fresh Air fans to pledge so that the station can afford to carry Fresh Air. There's a direct relationship between your pledge and your ability to continue listening to Fresh Air. I hope you'll call now. Thank you. The label fascist has been making a comeback in recent years, and this time it's coming as much from the right as the left. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has been wondering why Americans in particular are so fond of the epithet.
You'd figure no one would quarrel with describing Saddam Hussein's regime as fascist. It seemed to have a lot of the features of classical fascism, the militaristic nationalism, a secular religion of the state, and a government by secret police terror. And that's not to mention the grandiose monuments and the silly high-peaked officers' hats like the ones the Germans and Italians used to wear. But Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi stirred up a controversy recently when he complained to some British journalists that labeling Saddam a fascist disparaged Mussolini's regime, which he called comparatively benign. Mussolini never killed anyone, he said, not quite accurately. Mussolini used to send people on vacation in internal exile. Those fine distinctions are apt to be lost on Americans who don't have any intimate historical memories of fascism with a capital F. Fascist is a word that we throw around as easily as bastard and with no more heed to its literal meaning. That began with the 60s radicals who borrowed the epithet from the international left. It was a moment when polarizations were the common syntax, as Todd Gitlin has put it. The charge of fascism became a way of distancing yourself from the tired civilities of liberalism and rejecting all forms of social control. It stood in for any of the reasons why you weren't going to work on Maggie's farm no more. When William F. Buckley brought a defamation suit against the author of a 1969 book for calling him a fascist, the court ruled that the word was too vague to be actionable. The collapse of the radical movements of the 60s temporarily bleached fascist of its tone of rage and left it as a jocular term for anybody who was trying to impose a rigid pattern of behavior. There are fashion fascists and wine fascists, fascistic anti-smoking ordinances, and those fascistic seatbelts that lock you in automatically when you close the car door. But lately, fascist has been making a comeback as a political epithet. The anger stirred up by the Iraq War and domestic anti-terrorism programs has leftists pulling the word out of the closet along with tie-dye t-shirts and chants of hey, hey, ho, ho. You don't see it used much as an epithet in liberal publications like The Nation or The American Prospect, but the web is full of it. An Alta Vista search turns up more than 7,500 pages where fascist or fascism appear within 10 words of Ashcroft or Bush. But this time around, the right has adopted the epithet as well. Granted, it's appropriate to use fascist for Saddam Hussein's regime. But even there, it's striking that not many people were making that comparison at the time of the first Gulf War. In 1990, there were only 11 stories in major newspapers and magazines where somebody described Saddam's regime as fascist. Over the past year, there have been more than 150. And it's more of a stretch when people use phrases like Islamofascist to describe Islamic fundamentalists. The Taliban government may have been a nasty and repressive theocracy, but it didn't try to make religion subordinate to the state the way Hitler and Mussolini did, quite the opposite. It's as if the evils of the Taliban or bin Laden aren't sufficient to the day. We can't go after anybody now without comparing the campaign to the good war against Hitler and bringing the old rhetoric of appeasement into play. In fact, the mainstream right has taken to using fascist with a reckless brio that we used to associate with Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin. Rush Limbaugh has described Dick Gebhardt's health care program as fascist, and a while ago, the director of the American Conservative Union attached the label to Tim Robbins. And the irrepressible Ann Coulter compares Katie Couric to both Eva Braun and Joseph Goebbels. That's a hermaphroditic image clash I have some trouble getting my head around. The right's new enthusiasm for fascist has a lot to do with the fall of communism. which left those old epithets like pinko and communistic sounding quaint and retro. There was a time when the right would routinely refer to the ACLU as communist sympathizers or fellow travelers. Nowadays, Bill O'Reilly describes the group as a fascist organization which uses their legal clout to terrorize various school districts and individuals. That doesn't make a lot of historical sense. Real fascists didn't try to litigate their way to power. If they did, they wouldn't have been fascists. But then, few of the Americans who use fascist nowadays have much interest in dotting their historical I's. Like Big Brother or Orwellian, it's a spandex specter that you can stretch over everything that smacks of excessive control and surveillance, whether it's coming from the left, the right, or the seatbelt makers. The loose use of fascist comes particularly easy to Americans. For most of the peoples of Europe, the word still conjures up a shameful episode that has to be lived down, or in Berlusconi's case, excused away. But we can toss the fascist label around with easy abandon, secure in the conviction that really it can't happen here, as Sinclair Lewis entitled his 1935 novel about a fascist takeover of the U.S. We Americans may not have a vivid sense of history, but we react viscerally against anything that someone can get us to picture wearing boots and a high-peaked hat.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University's Center for the Study of Language and Information and the author of the book The Way We Talk Now. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, Robert Downey Jr. talks with us about acting, addiction, and his new film, The Singing Detective, based on the Dennis Potter miniseries that was broadcast on PBS. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.